You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
China passed Japan in GDP in the second quarter of 2010, moving into the number two spot behind the United States. But many economists don't expect the U.S. to retain the number one spot beyond 2030. And then there's India, with China's economy expanding at approximately 10% annually over the past 30 years, and India's at 7% in recent years, these two countries are poised to be the economic superpowers of the future. In a recent report, Goldman Sachs predicted that India's will be the second largest economy after China's by 2043. In his new book, Superpower, The Amazing Race Between China's Hare and India's Tortoise, Raghav Bal compares these two countries and their economies. It's published by Portfolio Penguin, and I'm very pleased that it brings Raghav Bal, the publisher of Forbes India and the founder and managing director of Network 18, India's largest television news and business network, to our show today. Hello.
Thank you.
The Times of India reported yesterday on a meeting that's going to take place tomorrow between India's Prime Minister, Manmohan Singh, and the Chinese Premier, Wen Jiabao. And the topic is to be about whether the world has enough space for the growth ambitions of India and China. Do you think it does?
Well, of course it does, because a lot of the growth is coming from both these countries right now. Clearly the world will have enough space for both of them. But the fact that they have space doesn't mean that the two will not be competing with each other. They will be competing for resources, for the same trade sort of space in the world. So it'll be competitive, but there's space.
Well, they share a fairly large border, the two countries. Is China India's largest trading partner?
Yes. The trade has gone up quite dramatically in the last 3 years. So China is India's largest trading partner, yes.
Because India can afford to buy those products? Or is there something else that's going on?
Well, it's the same thing why China exports so aggressively to the rest of the world. They are able to do it very cheap. They are able to, by the way they keep their currency undervalued, they're able to also make it very attractively priced for the rest of the world.
Now, the currency devaluation is something that has disturbed people in this country, our government. What about India?
Well, India has maintained a sort of diplomatic silence on it because it works for India. Since we are a net importer from China, since we run a deficit with China, any situation where the Indian rupee actually appreciates against the Chinese yuan is good for India because we are an import-dependent country relative to China. So India allows its currency to float. So India doesn't peg its currency like China does. And off late, the Indian rupee has been appreciating against the U.S. dollar. And since China holds the yuan so close to the dollar, almost sort of locked into the dollar, it works for India because India appreciates against the yuan as well.
Hasn't there been quite a bit of hostility between China and India since July over the stapled visas issue? I suspect most of the people in this country are unaware of what happened. So could you explain?
You know, India and China have had not a very peaceful history. In 1962, we went to war with each other. We have a very large border dispute because China believes that a large part of the territory that India has at the border was actually surreptitiously taken away from China by the British, not by India.
So this is like a Kashmir problem with China as well?
Kashmir is a slightly more problem where the population itself is divided between its loyalties between India and Pakistan.
No, I understand, but I'm saying is this analogous to that?
Yes, of course. It is a dispute. So there is that dispute that we have with China. And So we went to war. Ever since then, the relationships have been very tense between the two countries. While trade is growing, the fact is that China does quite a few things which actually make India quite uncomfortable. And the stapled visas issue that you talk about is a sort of red-hot thing that China puts on the table every time any Indian who's got something to do with Kashmir wants to travel to China. India says that this is a disputed territory. We don't recognize you as citizens of India, and therefore we would like to give you a separate category status, which India, of course, doesn't accept. So it's one of those things which, you know, is an irritant.
Now, is China doing this to be an irritant, or is it in support of Pakistani claims?
I think China would like to engage India and keep it engaged at a sort of low-level equilibrium because China knows that if India starts growing faster than China, which is quite possible, almost every economist now is saying that, then there is a chance that around 2040-50, India could be almost equal to China. So it pays China. It pays for China to keep India engaged in these skirmishes so that India remains confined to South Asia and doesn't develop any footprint outside of it.
Prime Minister Singh said that when he was a student, few dreamed that India or China or any other Asian nations would catch up with the industrialized world today. Few doubt that a fundamental change in the global economy is underway. What are we talking about here? Because it's not the same as what we have in the industrialized world. There is a big gap between rich and poor in both of these countries.
Oh, yes. You have to go back into history a bit. About 400 years ago, both China and India were accounting for roughly half the GDP of the world. China was about 28% and India was 23%. These were very large economies just 400 years ago. Then both these economies and countries came under colonial domination and completely lost their space. They came down to less than 10% of the world GDP. In the last 30 years, China has begun to open up to the world and has started growing. India has done the same about 20 years ago. So India is about 15 years behind China in that process. So as 3 billion people try and reform their economies and open up to the world and invite investments and grow on a home consumption base and an export base, you are seeing that shift of economic growth taking place to that part of the world. Do remember, as you've said, that both these countries have huge inequalities and a large number of very poor people. But they also, that means, have a very large supply of low-priced labor.
Is that why they are succeeding while Japan, which used to be so economically dynamic, is stagnant right now?
Yeah, Japan's got its own problems. Japan's got a very, very old population. Japan's got a very, very indebted government. And Japan simply doesn't seem to be having the same dynamism in its corporate sector that it once had. So Japan's got sort of got trapped in several things. China and India, on the other hand, are reaching out from poverty to becoming developed.
And Brazil is another case in point. The same sort of situation.
The same sort of situation. India stands out a bit because India India is a very large domestic consumption economy, like the U.S. Unlike China, which is a very high export and investment economy, and Brazil, which is a very large commodity export and production economy. India is more a classical economy like the U.S.
Despite what you said, Prime Minister Singh, when he was asked at a recent conference whether India and China were competitors, said there are enormous possibilities for the two countries to work together.
Yes, I mean,
of course, he's being diplomatic.
Yes, he's the prime minister of the country. And, you know, you really can't expect him to say these things out loud, what is deep down ingrained as a conviction in the government. The fact is that there is a large engagement between the two. But the fact also is that they are competitors.
My guest is Raghav Bal, who's the founder and managing director of Network 18, India's largest television news and business network. It also broadcasts content from CNN and CNBC. He is the publisher of Forbes India, and he's written a book called Superpower, with a question mark, The Amazing Race Between China's Hare and India's Tortoise. And let's talk about that. Let's talk about India. The economy of post-independence India was run on socialist democratic principles from 1947 until 1991, fairly recently. You write that its economy became known for being extensively regulated, protectionist, publicly owned, filled with pervasive corruption and slow growth. And I wonder if the socialist democratic principles were completely responsible. What about the older Indian traditions coupled with the legacy of years of British colonialism?
No, I think it was the fact that the government had too much of a heavy hand in the economy in those years when India was... India had a very dichotomous first 40 years of independence. We had an economy which was very largely state-controlled. But on the other hand, our civil society was actually mimicking or growing along the same lines as liberal Western democracies. So India had a situation where India had very high tariff walls. India had cut itself off from the rest of the world as far as economics was concerned. But within its civil society, all the institutions of democracy were blossoming. So a very mixed up sort of country was growing up in those 30, 40 years.
And weren't you beginning to build your media empire during that time?
No, we are entirely a child of the new India. We, in fact, set the company up in 1992. So it's 1 year after India began to open up. So.
And that was an invitation for something like what you did to happen?
Oh,
did,
yes,
did people see in 1992, oh, gee, the whole everything has changed?
Oh, absolutely. You know, before that, broadcasting was a state monopoly. It wasn't open to private players. It was only open to private players in 91, 92. Plus, people like us who had no family wealth or did not have any sources of capital, only had their own skills and intellectual capital, were allowed to get in foreign investment. That wasn't allowed in India before that. So things like private equity and venture capital and, you know, all these things became real in India only in the early 90s.
And there was an immediate transformation? Because it does usually take a certain amount of re-education, doesn't it?
Yes, the first 10 years from about 91 to 2000 were tough because the fact that India is as rowdy and as boisterous a democracy as any in the world. So it takes a long time for governments, when they're changing course, to build consensus.
More recently, India has put in policies to accelerate its growth even further. And by 2008, India's economy was the second fastest growing in the world.
That's correct. So the first decade was a decade where you were trying to put the building blocks in place and you were trying to change course and you were trying to build consensus amongst various interest groups. I think from 2000 onwards, that consensus was in place politically, economically, socially. And after 2008, when the world slipped into a huge recession, India was actually the strongest economy in the world, even stronger than China, because China fell from a growth rate of 13% to about 6%. China halved its growth rate. India fell from about 9.5 to 6.7. So India fell much less in growth rates and then bounced back.
And why was that? Because China depends so much on export?
Absolutely.
China, but doesn't India depend on export
no,
as well?
No, India doesn't depend as much on exports at all. India, if you look at India's economic structure, it's very similar to the U.S. 70% of India's GDP is made up of consumption, 58% by domestic households, which is the same in the U.S., 11% by the government. So we are not such a large export or investment-oriented economy.
But you also argue that one reason India's economy is taken more seriously today by the world has to do with the Lehman Brothers collapse of September 2008.
Absolutely, because the world saw that here was an economy which was the sturdiest in its bounce back. Here was an economy which wasn't affected, even 10% as much as the rest of the world. Here was an economy whose financial sector and banks came through completely unscathed. We did not have a single subprime problem in our banks. India's banks have a bad debt ratio of 2 to 3%, which is, you know, truly healthy.
So the regulations that were missing here were in place in India?
Yes, India, if anything, was very conservative and very cautious. And I think in the crisis that came out as a sign of strength.
But is India being mostly a service economy a good thing? Ultimately, in this country, there's been a lot of talk about how we lost an awful lot when we gave up the manufacturing sector.
Oh, no, absolutely. There is a lot of debate about that in India as well. India's manufacturing sector is growing, but India needs to do much more to get the manufacturing sector up and running much stronger. You know, again, like the U.S., we have very strong interest groups. I mean, China can go and do manufacturing by taking away land and creating special economic zones and by paying its workers a very low wage. In India, all these things are institutionally protected. We have a very strong labor union movement. We have a very strong lobby of farmers who will not sell their land so easily.
On the other hand, per capita income in India is just $1,030. That's 139th in the world, while China's is 6,567, 98th in the world. Neither is spectacular, but China is paying its workers better than India.
China of late has begun to pay its workers a fair wage in some areas. But, you know, per capita income is not to be correlated with wages because China has such a high component of export income and surpluses in that GDP that I don't think all of it goes into the wage sector of the economy.
Also, China has lost a lot of the people who were working in agriculture. In recent years, many have moved to the cities to work in manufacturing. Still, 52% of the half billion person workforce in India is still in agriculture.
Absolutely, which is because our manufacturing sector is not such a large sector. I mean, 28% of India's economy is manufacturing, and the economy size is about 1.4 trillion. China has about 50% in manufacturing, and the economy size is $5 trillion.
So could India wind up doing more manufacturing? That doesn't sound like the kind of workforce that would be prepared for that other kind of work.
No, of late India has begun to do has begun to show signs of doing well in manufacturing. I'll give you examples. Last year, India became the largest car exporter in the world. India became one of the largest mobile handset exporters in the world. So India's manufacturing sector, by virtue of the fact that it's not state controlled, but is entirely free for private enterprise, is now showing signs of being very competitive and showing much higher productivity. For instance, every unit of GDP growth in India has come at about a third of the resources that China uses for the same for one unit of GDP. So it is now increasingly becoming obvious that India is, because of the fact that it's such an intensely competitive economy, is turning out to be a more productive economy. And that is now translating itself into higher manufacturing growth. Having said that, India has to do a lot more.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll look at some of the less rosy aspects of this story. My guest is Raghav Bal, who's written a book called Superpower, The Amazing Race Between China's Hare and India's Tortoise. It is published by Penguin Portfolio, or Portfolio Penguin, is it?
It's...
whatever. Anyway, yes. Stay with us for more. Yeah. We are back with Raghav Bal, who is the founder and managing director of Network 18, India's largest television news and business network. He's also the publisher of Forbes India, and he's written a book called Superpower, The Amazing Race Between China's Hare and India's Tortoise, and is published by Portfolio Penguin. One comparison frequently made of late is India's problems in the run-up to hosting the Commonwealth Games earlier this month, in contrast to China's near-perfect hosting of the 2008 Olympic Games. Time magazine ran a photo essay on the stadium, the bridge collapse, problematic village, the village where the athletes were to stay, and just as the Games finished, a multi-agency investigation involving the Central Bureau of Investigation, the Watchdog Central Vigilance Commission, the Income Tax Department, the Directorate of Enforcement, and the Office of the Controller and Auditor General, all looking into Suresh Kalmadi's handling of the project. What do you expect to come out of that inquiry?
Two things about the Commonwealth Games that India went. To compare them to Beijing and China, I think, is an odious comparison because the scales of the two games are very different. Number two, as everybody admitted, including the Commonwealth Games Federation Chief Mike Fennell and everyone else at the end of the games, that perhaps the media had been overcritical of India's underpreparedness. And we do have an extremely vigilant and an extremely boisterous and loud media, which was very critical of how India had gone about. But once the game started, there was no incident of any kind. It all took place. So it wasn't as bad. But having said that, I quite agree with you that could India have done it better? Yes. And the other thing about India is that we, you know, in India, our government organizations are not that efficient. So unfortunately, this entire thing was run by government organizations. There was very little private sector involvement.
So there's a carryover from the old days, because the cost was $4.6 billion. And the original estimate that India used to win the games in 2003 was $500 million. The cost of corruption alone is estimated to perhaps winding up to being around $1.8 billion.
No. I think some of these things, the media, and we are a media company in India, one of the leading ones, so I think we need to own up to. A lot of the money has gone actually into permanent infrastructure creation in the city of New Delhi. We've got two 12-kilometer-long elevated roads. We've got a new airport terminal, which is now, I think, the fourth or the fifth largest in the world. We've got a metro, which has been expanded, which never existed before. A lot of those costs, all the additions to this infrastructure are included in that. I think the games per se cost about, about $600 million or something like that.
Well, I don't want to load it on, but just one more thing on this. India's Labor Department hasn't released the official death toll from all the construction for the games, but it's estimated to be between 45 to 109 deaths. And one of the dead was a 2-year-old who was run over by a truck on a construction site where her parents were working. And then there are accusations that very young children were being used to help build the stadium and to repair roads.
No, this is not a problem that is endemic only to the Commonwealth Games. I think this is a problem that India faces. The fact that we do have child labor, the fact that some of these things in India, wherever particularly state agencies are involved, is not done very effectively and efficiently. And I think this is the process of reform that India is in. However, I must equally say that there was a lot of exaggeration because the games did go off quite efficiently. They were not as efficient as we would have liked them to be. And some of these ills that you've talked about of child labor, as well as working conditions of laborers, which are not the best they should be, is not something that is specific to the Commonwealth Games. That is a problem that India needs to address across all other industries as well.
Well, I mentioned earlier that per capita income is just $1,030 a year. Are steps being taken to improve wages for the vast majority of workers?
Well, India, the people in the organized labor in India are paid minimum wages, and they've got very strong labor union protection, and they've got other facilities and rights, whether it's health, etc. So that the organized part is there. It's the unorganized part, which is the large part, where a lot of people are involved in agriculture and agricultural related activities, or people who work in the household sector as housemaids or house servants. There, India needs to do much more institutional reform.
What about there are some other areas that seem to me do have to be resolved before India can really move ahead? One is sectarian violence. Another is the rebellions. There's a Maoist rebellion and a couple of other minor rebellions that continue throughout India. But let's talk about sectarian violence first, because India has the second largest Muslim population in the world. But despite that, there's constant tension between Hindus and Muslims.
There is. There is a lot of bonhomie and peaceful living as well. A lot of being a democracy, a lot of the bad news gets exaggerated. It's like racial strife in the U.S. I mean, there are problems, but it hasn't overtaken the country or drowned the country. And that's certainly the case with India as well.
But over the years, many people would argue it had a very strong economic effect on this country. And because of that, there have been all sorts of other problems that have arisen. And in the last 40 or 50 years, we haven't seen the kinds of things we've seen in India, where people have run through villages and killed people, or attacked trains and killed people.
Yes, we have. And not for a minute am I saying that those things don't exist. All I'm saying is that there is vast areas of India where Hindus and Muslims live absolutely peacefully. There are pockets where there is violence. Some of it is also politically incited by narrow interest groups. There is. And I think these are problems that democracies deal with. Nowhere near does India have the kind of sectarian violence or the kind of problems that you are seeing in non-democratic countries around the world. As far as the Maoist issue is concerned, yes, we have pockets in our forest areas where there is this the fight between the haves and the have-nots, essentially over mineral and land resources, because India does have very outdated laws in both these areas. India does have an extremely vocal and assertive civil rights movement and activists who are there in the vanguard of these movements. India does have an extremely vibrant press, which brings these issues up to the fore. And that's the kind of pressure that is working on the government now to go out and reform these rules so that land as well as mineral wealth, the people who have traditionally been owners of these, have a much more a fair stake in these resources. So I think these are processes which India is going through. It's all happening in a very open society. It's all happening in a very, very open and transparent democracy. It's happening within a media sector, which, as I said, is perhaps the most boisterous in the world.
Well, there also have been a number of serious accidents on trains in India. India has this extensive railway system. Won't the infrastructure need to be improved as the economy expands?
Absolutely. If there's one large failing of a sector within India which has not kept pace with India's needs, is the railways. In fact, the railways in India have hardly seen the kind of investment that they need to make. And this, again, comes down to what I have been saying, and a lot of people have been saying, that the government hasn't decontrolled the railways. Railways is one sector which has seen perhaps the least amount of reform, because it continues to be a departmental undertaking of the government. Therefore, it continues to have all the ills that come with being that. Clearly, railways is one area India needs to invest much, much more in.
Well, you talked about the openness generally of Indian society, the strength of the free press. China has been able to grow its economy very fast while keeping a tight rein on its populace and on the flow of information. Do you think it can continue that way, or are democratic reforms inevitable?
I think China's got a problem on its hands now because these are the forces which get unleashed when you open up your economy and when you start getting institutions of private ownership and private wealth, and people then demand commensurate freedoms. Will China be able to resist the demand for democracy? I think this is something that the world will watch very, very closely. Of late, we have seen that the Chinese government seems to be backtracking a bit. We did see some amount of constitutional reform in about 2003 to 2006, 2007. But in the last couple of years, we seem to be seeing some backtracking. And that's a cause of worry for the rest of the world, because there is an amount of assertiveness that China seems to be now showing to the world, especially after China has emerged strong through the global economic crisis. There seems to be a feeling in the rulers in China that we can now have a much larger space and dictate much more to the world. And that is matched by a domestic sector where also they seem to be pulling back on the kind of limited opening up that they had experimented with.
As we've seen, the winner of this year's Nobel Peace Prize has caused a big stir in China, because they are outraged that the world would even try to pressure them in that way by naming somebody who they've imprisoned.
Well, he's been imprisoned because he ran Charter 08, which was really a plea for democracy. And really, it wasn't a plea for very huge amount of democracy. It was a plea for opening up and giving more human rights. Remember, China, convicts and hangs or executes almost 1,500 to 1,600 people every year. That's almost five a day. Remember,
that's
that
worse than Texas.
Remember, a country like India hasn't executed people in the last 60 years what China does in a week.
Has China's growth come at a serious cost? There's been a lot of corruption. There have been many unsafe products. Unfortunately, we find out about them after people get hurt. There have been adulterated foodstuffs.
Yes, which is what I'm saying, that a lot of China's problems are suppressed and they bubble up to the surface.
And things like that are not happening in India. Isn't that just natural every time there is this kind of economic growth spurt?
Well, of course they're happening in India. They're happening in India as much as they would happen in any open democratic society where excesses happen. I mean, if there is a Bernie Madoff scam in the US, India has its share of scams. But then it's not as if institutions have completely broken down. And I think that's the great strength of India compared to a China, that we have troubles, we have problems, which are there in several other democracies of the world. They come out in the open. There is more debate on them than perhaps sometimes they merit, but they lead to corrective action.
So I'm not sure I understand what you're saying here. I mean, the subtitle of your book is The Amazing Race Between China's Hare and India's Tortoise. Are you saying that India's tortoise is going to win this race ultimately? Are you saying that, Or because you're an economist, or are you saying that because you're an Indian?
No, let me tell you what I mean by this race. China, by virtue of the fact that it's a totalitarian state, has been able to extract massive surpluses from its workers, its peasants, its trading partners, its consumers, and has put those surpluses through investment back into the economy. So they've had a very capital-intensive model of growth, and because they did not have institutional problems to deal with, they managed to grow so fast. However, the fact that the Chinese economy is four times India's could mislead you into thinking that they have gone irretrievably ahead. Because if you go back just 10 years, China was at the same stage that India is today. So the difference between the two countries is no more than 8 or 9 years. And of late, India's growth has been steadier, sturdier, and now everyone says that India will actually start growing faster. Therefore, if you look at this race, not in terms of a few years, but over the next 20 to 30 years, then the kind of institutional strength that India has, whether it's in innovation, whether it's entrepreneurship, whether it's in its consumption base, whether it's in an open and transparent society, the odds, I say, are half. While if you were to look at the quantities today, you'd believe the odds are four times in favor of China and only once in favor of India.
Isn't one of the things that China has done that India hasn't done is improve its education system? India still has a lot of illiterate people. China hardly has any.
Yes. That's one area in which China
has. And you really can't grow unless your people can read.
Well, you're absolutely right. And a lot of these things are happening in India, which are not, which are happening because if you look at the people under 25 in India, the literacy rates are over 85%. So you're not that far behind among the youth and the younger people. In China, the literacy rates are above 90%. China has much higher rates of female literacy, where India has to catch up. Clearly, these are the challenges before India. So when it comes to agriculture, when it comes to education, when it comes to health, these are three areas in which India needs to focus much more.
When we were talking earlier about post-independence India, the socialist democratic approach, I asked you about whether one of the deterrents to growth was Indian traditions. The Wall Street Journal just reported in September that for the first time there's going to be a census in India to assess the caste system. And it's my sense that the caste system has been a major deterrent of growth. If people are not encouraged to rise above the limitations imposed on them, you're always going to have a problem with your economy.
Well, there are realities that that countries have to deal with. The fact that there is a caste structure,
which is supposed to have been eliminated at the moment of independence. It was written into the Constitution.
And it hasn't. Some social realities are deeper ingrained than you and I and any other person would wish them to be. But the fact is that they are. Now, caste system in India is also the basis for a lot of affirmative action. So therefore, the government has decided in its wisdom, a lot of people disagree with that decision, but in its wisdom, the government has decided that we might as well have a caste census so that we know and have a much better basis for the affirmative action that we are going with. Otherwise, the data that affirmative action is based on is from 1931, when the last caste census was done under the British. So you have a country which has grown four times in population since then. You are today basing your reservation in education, reservation in jobs, on data which you don't have. Therefore, there was a school of thought which said that if we are going to be using affirmative action as an instrument of social upliftment, and it is, by the way, working in several areas, we have today India has in its largest state a so-called untouchable caste person, a woman on top of that, as the chief minister, who's an extremely popular chief minister. So affirmative action clearly is working. But then the feeling was that if you have to have affirmative action, you might as well base it on far more scientific data. So you might as well get updated information.
I'm sure that it's gotten more complicated over the years because of intermarriage and all sorts of other changes, people who have broken out of the caste system. So there'll be a positive and a negative to come out of this census.
Oh, absolutely. But affirmative action and political assertion by the so-called lower caste is something that you have to now see to believe. As I said, the largest state in India has a woman who comes from so-called untouchable caste, and she is a very strong political leader. And so have several other states in India who've got now what are called other backward castes as the chief ministers. So there is a huge political empowerment that is taking place of people who were considered untouchables or of a lower caste.
Raghav Bahl, that's spelled R-A-G-H-A-V-B-A-H-L. His book, Superpower, The Amazing Race Between China's Hare and India's Tortoise, it is published by Portfolio Penguin. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed this.